This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Mastering the Market Cycle, Getting the Odds on Your Side. Written by Howard Marks. Performed by L.J. Ganser. Introduction performed by Howard Marks.
Visual aids found in the print edition of this book are available to you as a downloadable PDF. To access this file, please click the link on the product page where you purchased this title. Thank you.
Introduction. 7 years ago, I wrote a book called The Most Important Thing, Uncommon Sense for the Thoughtful Investor, regarding where investors should direct their greatest attention. In it, I said, the most important thing is being attentive to cycles. The truth, however, is that I applied the label the most important thing to 19 other things as well. There is no single most important thing in investing. Every one of the 20 elements I discussed in The Most Important Thing is absolutely essential for anyone who wishes to be a successful investor. Vince Lombardi, the legendary coach of the Green Bay Packers, is famous for having said, "Winning isn't everything, it's the only thing." I've never been able to figure out exactly what Lombardi meant by that statement, but there's no doubt he considered winning the most important thing. Likewise, I can't say an understanding of cycles is everything in investing, or the only thing, but for me, it's certainly right near the top of the list. Most of the great investors I've known over the years have had an exceptional sense for how cycles work in general, and where we stand in the current one. That sense permits them to do a superior job of positioning portfolios for what lies ahead. Good cycle timing, combined with an effective investment approach and the involvement of exceptional people, has accounted for the vast bulk of the success of my firm, Oaktree Capital Management. It's for that reason, and because I find something particularly intriguing about the fluctuations of cycles, and because where we stand in the cycle is one of the things my clients ask about most, and finally, because so little has been written about the essential nature of cycles, that I decided to follow The Most Important Thing with a book devoted entirely to an exploration of cycles. I hope you'll find it of use. Some patterns and events recur regularly in our environment, influencing our behavior and our lives. The winter is colder and snowier than the summer, and the daytime is lighter than the night. Thus, we plan ski trips for the winter and sailing trips for the summer, and our work and recreation for the daytime and our sleeping at night. We turn on the lights as evening draws nigh and turn them off when we go to bed. We unpack our winter coats as the winter approaches and our bathing suits for the summer. While some people swim in the ocean in winter for exhilaration, and some elect to work the night shift to free up their days, the vast majority of us follow the normal circadian patterns, making everyday life easier. We humans use our ability to recognize and understand patterns to make our decisions easier, increase benefits, and avoid pains. Importantly, we depend on our knowledge of recurring patterns, so we won't have to reconsider every decision from scratch. We know hurricanes are more likely in September, so we avoid the Caribbean at that time of year. We New Yorkers schedule our trips to Miami and Phoenix for the winter months when the temperature differential is a positive, not a negative. And we don't have to wake each day in January and decide anew whether to dress for warmth or cold. Economies, companies, and markets also operate pursuant to patterns. Some of these patterns are commonly called cycles. They arise from naturally occurring phenomena, but importantly also from the ups and downs of human psychology and from the resultant human behavior. Because human psychology and behavior play such a big part in creating them, these cycles aren't as regular as the cycles of clock and calendar, but they still give rise to better and worse times for certain actions. And they can profoundly affect investors. If we pay attention to cycles, we can come out ahead. If we study past cycles, understand their origins and import, and keep alert for the next one, we don't have to reinvent the wheel in order to understand every investment environment anew, and we have less chance of being blindsided by events. We can master these recurring patterns for our betterment. It's my primary message that we should pay attention to cycles. Perhaps I should say, listen to them. Dictionary.com supplies two closely related but distinct definitions. for the word listen. The first is to attend closely for the purpose of hearing. The second is to heed. Both definitions are relevant to what I'm writing about. In order to properly position a portfolio for what's going on in the environment and for what that implies regarding the future of markets, the investor has to maintain a high level of attention. Events happen equally to everyone who is operating in a given environment, but not everyone listens to them equally in the sense of paying attention, being aware of them, and thus potentially figuring out their import. And certainly not everyone heeds equally. By heed, I mean obey, bear in mind, be guided by, or take to heart. Or in other words, to absorb a lesson and follow its dictates. Perhaps I can better convey this heeding sense for listening by listing its antonyms. Ignore, disregard, discount, reject, overlook, neglect, shun, flout, disobey, tune out, turn a deaf ear to, or be inattentive to. Invariably, investors who disregard where they stand in cycles are bound to suffer serious consequences. In order to get the most out of this book and to do the best job of dealing with cycles, an investor has to learn to recognize cycles, assess them, look for the instructions they imply, and do what they tell him to do. See my note below regarding my use of male pronouns. If an investor listens in this sense, he will be able to convert cycles from the wild, uncontrollable force that wreaks havoc into a phenomenon that can be understood and taken advantage of, a vein that can be mined for significant opportunities. A winning investment philosophy can be created only through the combination of a number of essential elements. A technical education in accounting, finance, and economics provides the foundations, necessary, but far from sufficient. A view on how markets work is important. You should have one before you set out to invest. But it must be added to, questioned, refined, and reshaped as you proceed. Some of your initial views will come from what you've read, so reading is an essential building block. Continuing to read will enable you to increase the efficacy of your approach, both embracing those ideas you find appealing and disregarding those you don't. Importantly, it's great to read outside the strict boundaries of investing. Legendary investor Charlie Munger often points to the benefits of reading broadly. History and processes in other fields can add greatly to effective investment approaches and decisions. Exchanging ideas with fellow investors can be an invaluable source of growth. Given the non-scientific nature of investing, there's no such thing as being finished with your learning, and no individual has a monopoly on insight. Investing can be solitary, but I think those who practice it in solitude are missing a lot, both intellectually and interpersonally. Finally, there really is no substitute for experience. Every year I have come to view investing differently, and every cycle I've lived through has taught me something about how to cope with the next one. I recommend a long career, and I see no reason to stop anytime soon. Writing my books has given me a wonderful vehicle for acknowledging the people who have contributed to my investment insight and the texture of my working life. I've gained a great deal from reading the work of Peter Bernstein, John Kenneth Galbraith, Nassim Nicholas Taleb, and Charlie Ellis. I've continued to pick up pointers from the people I cited in The Most Important Thing and others, including Seth Klarman, Charlie Munger, Warren Buffett, Bruce Newberg, Michael Milken, Jacob Rothschild, Todd Combs, Roger Altman, Joel Greenblatt, Peter Kaufman, and Doug Kass. And since Nancy and I moved to New York in 2013 to follow our kids, I've been fortunate to add Oscar Schaefer, Jim Tisch, and Ajit Jain to this circle. Each of these people's ways of looking at things has added to mine. Finally, I want to return to the most important collaborators, my Oak Tree co-founders, Bruce Karsh, Sheldon Stone, Richard Masson, and Larry Keel. They honored me by adopting my philosophy as the foundation for Oak Tree's investment approach. They applied it skillfully and thus gained recognition for it, and they helped me add to it over the 30-plus years we've been associated. As indicated in what follows, Bruce and I have exchanged ideas and backed each other up almost daily over that period, and my give and take with him, especially in the most difficult of times, has played a particularly indispensable part in the development of the approach to cycles on which this book is based. I also want to thank the people who played important parts in this book's creation. My talented editor at HMH, Rick Wolf. My resourceful agent, Jim Levine, who brought me to Rick. My great friend, Karen Mack Goldsmith, who pushed me at every turn to make the book more appealing. And my highly supportive long-term assistant, Caroline Held. I particularly want to cite Professor Randy Krosner of the University of Chicago's Booth School, who helped out by reviewing the chapters on the economic cycle and government intervention with it. Since knowledge is cumulative, but we never know it all, I look forward to learning more in the years ahead. In investing, there is nothing that always works, since the environment is always changing, and investors' efforts to respond to the environment cause it to change further. Thus, I hope to know things in the future that I don't know now, and I look forward to sharing them in memos and books yet to come. Author's notes. 1. As I did in The Most Important Thing, I want to issue up front a blanket apology for my consistent use of male pronouns. It can be force of habit for someone who started to write more than 60 years ago. I find it much easier and more attractive to write he than he slash she. Alternating between he and she seems forced, and I dislike the use of they when the subject is a single person. The exceptional women I've been privileged to work with over the course of my career know I absolutely think every bit as much of them as professionals and investors as I do their male counterparts. 2. Also, as in The Most Important Thing, in order to make my points here, I will borrow from time to time from the client memos I've written over the years, starting in 1990. I'll also borrow from my first book. I could go to the trouble of reinventing the wheel and writing on these subjects anew, but I won't. Instead, I'll lift key passages from my book and memos that I think make their point clearly. I hope my doing so won't make those who buy this book feel they've received less than their money's worth. In order to advance the purposes of this book, I will occasionally add a few words or delete a few from the passages I cite, or present paragraphs in an order different from that in which they appeared in the original. Since they're my passages, I think it's okay to do so without noting it in every case, but I do it only to increase their helpfulness, not to alter their meaning or make them more correct with the benefit of hindsight. 3. And finally, as in The Most Important Thing, I'll be dealing here with a topic that, like investing in general, is complex and involves elements that overlap and can't be neatly segregated into discrete chapters. Since some of those elements are touched on in multiple places, you'll likewise find some instances of repetition where I include noteworthy quotations from others or citations from my book and memos that I can't resist using more than once. 4. Please note that when I talk about investing, I'll assume the investor is buying, holding, or, as we say, being long in the expectation that certain assets will appreciate. This is as opposed to selling short securities that one doesn't own in the hope they'll decline. Investors aren't always long rather than short, but most of the time they are. The number of people who sell stocks short or ever get net short, that is, whose short positions have a total value exceeding that of the stocks they own, is tiny relative to those who don't. Thus, in this book, I'm going to speak exclusively about investing in things because they're expected to rise, not selling assets short in the hope they'll fall. 5. Lastly, whereas I first conceived of this book as being just about cycles, as I wrote, I came up with ideas on lots of other topics, such as asset selection and catching falling knives. Rather than disregard them, I've included them here too. I hope you'll be glad they're here, providing a bonus rather than straying from the mission.
Chapter 1. Why Study Cycles? The odds change as our position in the cycles changes. If we don't change our investment stance as these things change, we're being passive regarding cycles. In other words, we're ignoring the chance to tilt the odds in our favor. But if we apply some insight regarding cycles, we can increase our bets and place them on more aggressive investments when the odds are in our favor, and we can take money off the table and increase our defensiveness when the odds are against us. Investing is a matter of preparing for the financial future. It's simple to define the task. We assemble portfolios today that we hope will benefit from the events that unfold in the years ahead. For professional investors, success consists of doing this better than the average investor, or outperforming an assigned market benchmark, the performance of which is determined by the actions of all the other investors. But achieving that kind of success is no small challenge. Although it's very easy to generate average investment performance, it's quite hard to perform above average. One of the most important foundational elements of my investment philosophy is my conviction that we can't know what the macro future has in store for us in terms of things like economies, markets, or geopolitics. Or, to put it more precisely, few people are able, on balance, to know more about the macro future than others. And it's only if we know more than others, whether that consists of having better data, doing a superior job of interpreting the data we have, knowing what actions to take on the basis of our interpretation, or having the emotional fortitude required to take those actions, that our forecasts will lead to outperformance. In short, if we have the same information as others, analyze it the same way, reach the same conclusions, and implement them the same way, we shouldn't expect the process to result in outperformance. And it's very difficult to be consistently superior in those regards as relates to the macro. So, in my view, trying to predict what the macro future holds is unlikely to help investors achieve superior investment performance. Very few investors are known for having outperformed through macro forecasting. Warren Buffett once told me about his two criteria for a desirable piece of information. It has to be important, and it has to be knowable. Although everyone knows that macro developments play a dominant role in determining the performance of markets these days, macro investors, as a whole, have shown rather unimpressive results. It's not that the macro doesn't matter, but rather that very few people can master it. For most, it's just not knowable, or not knowable well enough and consistently enough for it to lead to outperformance. Thus, I dismiss macro prediction as something that will bring investment success for the vast majority of investors, and I certainly include myself in that group. If that's so, what's left? While there are lots of details and nuances, I think we can most gainfully spend our time in three general areas. Trying to know more than others about what I call the knowable, the fundamentals of industries, companies, and securities. Being disciplined as to the appropriate price to pay for a participation in those fundamentals, and understanding the investment environment we're in and deciding how to strategically position our portfolios for it. A great deal has been written on the first two topics. Together, these constitute the key ingredients in security analysis and value investing, judgments regarding what an asset can produce in the future, usually in terms of earnings or cash flow, and what those prospects make the asset worth today. What do value investors do? They strive to take advantage of discrepancies between price and value. In order to do that successfully, they have to A, quantify an asset's intrinsic value and how it's likely to change over time, and B, assess how the current market price compares with the asset's intrinsic value, past prices for the asset, the prices of other assets, and theoretically fair prices for assets in general. Then they use that information to assemble portfolios. Most of the time, it's their immediate goal to hold investments offering the best available value propositions, the assets with the greatest upside potential, and/or the best ratio of upside potential to downside risk. You might argue that assembling a portfolio should consist of nothing more than identifying the assets with the highest value and the ones whose prices most understate their value. That may be true in general and in the long term, but I think another element can profitably enter into the process, properly positioning a portfolio for what's likely to happen in the market in the years immediately ahead. In my view, the greatest way to optimize the positioning of a portfolio at a given point in time is through deciding what balance it should strike between aggressiveness and defensiveness. And I believe the aggressiveness-defensiveness balance should be adjusted over time in response to changes in the state of the investment environment and where a number of elements stand in their cycles. The key word is calibrate. The amount you have invested, your allocation of capital among the various possibilities, and the riskiness of the things you own all should be calibrated along a continuum that runs from aggressive to defensive. When we're getting value cheap, we should be aggressive. When we're getting value expensive, we should pull back. Yet again? September 2017. Calibrating one's portfolio position is what this book is mostly about. One of the key words required if one is to understand the reasons for studying cycles is tendencies. If the factors that influence investing were regular and predictable, for example, if macro forecasting worked, we would be able to talk about what will happen. Yet the fact that that's not the case doesn't mean we're helpless in contemplating the future. Rather, we can talk about the things that might happen or should happen and how likely they are to happen. Those things are what I call tendencies. In the investment world, we talk about risk all the time, but there's no universal agreement about what risk is or what it should imply for investors' behavior. Some people think risk is the likelihood of losing money, and others, including many finance academics, think risk is the volatility of asset prices or returns. And there are many other kinds of risk. Too many to cover here. I lean heavily toward the first definition. In my view, risk is primarily the likelihood of permanent capital loss. But there's also such a thing as opportunity risk, the likelihood of missing out on potential gains. Put the two together, and we see that risk is the possibility of things not going the way we want. What is the origin of risk? One of my favorite investment philosophers, the late Peter Bernstein, said in an issue of his Economics and Portfolio Strategy newsletter titled "Can We Measure Risk with a Number?" June 2007, essentially risk says we don't know what's going to happen. We walk every moment into the unknown. There's a range of outcomes, and we don't know where the actual outcome is going to fall within the range. Often we don't know what the range is. You'll find below a few ideas, summarized very briefly from the full treatment provided in my memo, Risk Revisited Again, of June 2015, that I think follow directly from the starting point provided by Bernstein. They might help you understand and cope with risk. As retired London Business School professor Elroy Dimson said, risk means more things can happen than will happen. For each event in economics, business, and markets, among other things, if only one thing could happen, if there could be only one outcome, and if it was predictable, there would, of course, be no uncertainty or risk. And with no uncertainty regarding what was going to happen, in theory, we could know exactly how to position our portfolios to avoid loss and garner maximum gains. But in life and in investing, since there can be many different outcomes, uncertainty and risk are inescapable. As a consequence of the above, the future should be viewed not as a single fixed outcome that's destined to happen and capable of being predicted, but as a range of possibilities and, hopefully, on the basis of insight into their respective likelihoods, as a probability distribution. Probability distributions reflect one's view of tendencies. Investors, or anyone hoping to deal successfully with the future, have to form probability distributions, either explicitly or informally. If it's done well, those probabilities will be helpful in determining one's proper course of action. But it's still essential to bear in mind that even if we know the probabilities, that doesn't mean we know what's going to happen. Outcomes regarding a given matter may be governed by a probability distribution in the long run, but with regard to the outcome of a single event, there can be great uncertainty. Any of the outcomes included in a distribution can occur, albeit with varying probabilities, since the process through which the outcome is chosen will be affected not only by the merits, but also by randomness. To invert Dimson's statement, even though many things can happen, only one will. We may know what to expect on average, but that may have no connection with what actually will happen. In my way of thinking about it, investment success is like the choosing of a lottery winner. Both are determined by one ticket, the outcome, being pulled from a bowl full, the full range of possible outcomes. In each case, one outcome is chosen from among the many possibilities. Superior investors are people who have a better sense for what tickets are in the bowl, and thus for whether it's worth participating in the lottery. In other words, while superior investors, like everyone else, don't know exactly what the future holds, they do have an above-average understanding of future tendencies. As an aside, I want to add a thought here. Most people think the way to deal with the future is by formulating an opinion as to what's going to happen, perhaps via a probability distribution. I think there are actually two requirements, not one. In addition to an opinion regarding what's going to happen, people should have a view on the likelihood that their opinion will prove correct. Some events can be predicted with substantial confidence. For example, will a given investment-grade bond pay the interest it promises? Some are uncertain. Will Amazon still be the leader in online retailing in 10 years? And some are entirely unpredictable. Will the stock market go up or down next month? It's my point here that not all predictions should be treated as equally likely to be correct, and thus they shouldn't be relied on equally. I don't think most people are as aware of this as they should be. A good way to think about the superior investor described above is as someone whose insight into tendencies permits him to tilt the odds in his favor. Let's say there are 100 balls in a jar, some black and some white. Which color should you bet will come up? If you don't know anything about the contents of the jar, betting would be just a matter of guessing, uninformed speculation. The situation is similar if you know there are 50 black and 50 white. You can just as wisely bet on black as white, but doing either wouldn't give you more than a 50-50 chance of being right. Thus, betting would be dumb, unless you're offered odds that are at least even, and unless you're able to avoid paying an admission charge. In investing, a commission or bid-asked spread to play. Betting on black or white at even odds wouldn't be very profitable other than if you got lucky, and luck isn't something you can count on. Betting, in the absence of a knowledge edge regarding the contents of the jar, wouldn't be dependably profitable. But what if you do have special insight regarding the contents of the jar? Let's say you know there are 70 black balls and 30 white. That could allow you to win more often than you lose. If you can bet $10 on black against someone who gives you even odds, you'll win $10 70% of the time and lose $10 only 30% of the time, for an expected profit of $40 per 10 picks. Note, these will be the outcomes on average over a large number of trials, but they are subject to significant variation in the short run due to randomness. Of course, your betting partner will only give you even odds on a bet on black, A, if he doesn't know the bulls are 70% black and 30% white, and B, if he doesn't know that you do know. If he knew as much as you do about the contents of the jar, he would give you only 30 to 70 odds on a bet on black, and the bet would be back to being profitless. In other words, in order to win at this game, more often than you lose, you have to have a knowledge advantage. That's what the superior investor has. He knows more than others about the future tendencies. Yet, it's important to remember what I said earlier. Even if you know the probabilities, that is, even if you do have superior insight regarding the tendencies, you still don't know what's going to happen. Even if the ratio of balls in the jar is 70 black to 30 white, you still don't know what color the next one picked will be. Yes, it's more likely to be black than white, but it'll still be white 30% of the time, when there are white balls as well as black in the jar, and especially when random and exogenous forces are at work when the next ball is chosen, there can be no certainty regarding the outcome. But, all this being said, there doesn't have to be certainty in order for the game to be worth playing. A knowledge advantage regarding the tendencies is enough to create success in the long run. And that brings us to the payoff from understanding cycles. The average investor doesn't know much about it. He doesn't fully understand the nature and importance of cycles. He hasn't been around long enough to have lived through many cycles. He hasn't read financial history and thus learned the lessons of past cycles. He sees the environment primarily in terms of isolated events, rather than taking note of recurring patterns and the reasons behind them. Most important, he doesn't understand the significance of cycles and what they can tell him about how to act. The superior investor is attentive to cycles. He takes note of whether past patterns seem to be repeating, gains a sense for where we stand in the various cycles that matter, and knows those things have implications for his actions. This allows him to make helpful judgments about cycles and where we stand in them. Specifically, are we close to the beginning of an upswing or in the late stages? If a particular cycle has been rising for a while, has it gone so far that we're now in dangerous territory? Does investors' behavior suggest they're being driven by greed or by fear? Do they seem appropriately risk-averse or foolishly risk-tolerant? Is the market overheated and overpriced, or is it frigid and thus cheap because of what's been going on cyclically? Taken together, does our current position in the cycle imply that we should emphasize defensiveness or aggressiveness? Attention to these elements gives the superior investor an edge that allows him to win more often than he loses. He understands the tendencies or odds. Thus, he knows something that others don't about the color of the balls in the jar. He has a sense for whether the chances of winning exceed the chances of losing. Thus, he is able to invest more when they are favorable and less when they aren't. Importantly, all these things can be assessed on the basis of observations regarding current conditions. As we'll see in later chapters, they can tell us how to prepare for the future without requiring that we be able to predict the future. Remember, where we stand in the various cycles has a strong influence on the odds. For example, as we'll see in later chapters, opportunities for investment gains improve when the economy and company profits are more likely to swing upward than down, investor psychology is sober rather than buoyant, investors are conscious of risk, or, even better, overly concerned about risk, and market prices haven't moved too high. There are cycles in all these things, and more, and knowing where we stand within them can help us tilt the odds in our favor. In short, the movement through the cycle repositions the probability distribution governing future events. Perhaps I should illustrate with regard to investment returns. When our position in the various cycles is neutral, the outlook for returns is normal. When the cycles are positioned propitiously, the probability distribution shifts to the right, such that the outlook for returns is now tilted in our favor. Our favorable position in the cycles makes gains more likely and losses less so. But when the cycles are at dangerous extremes, the odds are against us, meaning the likelihoods are less good. There's less chance of gain and more chance of loss. The same is true when our position changes in only a single cycle. For example, regardless of what's going on with regard to the economy and company profits, that is, as the academics say, ceteris paribus, or all other things being equal, the outlook for returns will be better when investors are depressed and fearful, and thus allow asset prices to fall, and worse when they're euphoric and greedy and drive prices upward. The odds change as our position in the cycles changes. If we don't change our investment stance as these things change, we're being passive regarding cycles. In other words, we're ignoring the chance to tilt the odds in our favor. But if we apply some insight regarding cycles, we can increase our bets and place them on more aggressive investments when the odds are in our favor. And we can take money off the table and increase our defensiveness when the odds are against us. The student of cycles doesn't know for a fact what's going to happen next, any more than someone with insight regarding the balls in the jar knows what color ball will come out next. But both have a knowledge advantage regarding what's likely. The student's knowledge of cycles and appreciation for where we stand at a point in time can make a big contribution to the edge that must be present in order for an investor to achieve superior results. The ball chooser, who knows the ratio is 70-30, has an advantage. So does the investor, who knows better than others where we stand in the cycle. It's the purpose of this book to help you become that person. In that interest, I'll describe a number of cyclical processes that I watched take place in real time. The oscillations might seem extreme, and in fact they may be, since they're chosen from the experience of a half century to prove a point. And they may give the impression that the events under discussion were compressed in time, whereas in truth, they took months and years to develop. But these examples are real, and I hope they'll make my message clear. Chapter 2. The Nature of Cycles. Most people think of cycles in terms of a series of events, and most people understand that these events regularly follow each other in a usual sequence. Upswings are followed by downswings, and then eventually by new upswings. But to have a full understanding of cycles, that's not enough. The events in the life of a cycle shouldn't be viewed merely as each being followed by the next, but, much more importantly, as each causing the next. When I meet with oak tree clients, they almost always ask me to help them make sense of what's going on in the world or in the market. They usually want to know about one particular cycle or another and where we stand in it. I invariably pull out a sheet of paper and make a drawing to aid the discussion. There's usually a line that stretches from lower left to upper right. Another line fluctuates up and down around it. When I started to organize for the task of writing this book, I went through my oak tree bag and found a large number of such drawings. I had drawn them in the course of describing several different phenomena, and they were annotated differently. But each one related to a cycle worthy of discussion. The chapters in this book will generally be devoted to those cyclical phenomena. Before moving ahead with my discussion of cycles, I want to return to something I mentioned in The Most Important Thing. I confess that I alternate between discussing the ups and downs of cycles and the side-to-side oscillations of pendulums, applying the cycle label to some phenomena, and as seen in Chapter 7, the pendulum label to others, usually those connected to psychology. Sometimes I'll talk about a given phenomenon as a cycle and sometimes as a pendulum. But when pressed, I find it hard to distinguish between the two, or to say why one gets one label and not the other. I tend to think about things visually, so perhaps I can use an image to describe the connection between cycles and pendulums. As I will describe at length later, cycles oscillate around a midpoint, or a secular trend. Similarly, pendulums hang over a midpoint, or norm, and swing back and forth from there. But if you take the hang point of the pendulum, turn it on its side, and drag it from left to right as it oscillates, what do you get? A cycle. There really is no fundamental difference. I'll even admit that a pendulum is little more than a special case of a cycle, or perhaps just a different way to make reference to particular cycles. My reasons for referring to some things as cycles and others as pendulums are clear to me. I hope they will become clear to you as well. Or, at minimum, I hope my use of the two terms won't detract from what you take from this book. The bottom line is that in the world investors inhabit, cycles rise and fall, and pendulums swing back and forth. Cycles and pendulum swings come in many forms, and relate to a wide variety of phenomena, but the underlying reasons for them, and the patterns they produce, have a lot in common, and they tend to be somewhat consistent over time. Or, as Mark Twain is reputed to have said, although there's no evidence he actually said it, "History doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme." Whether Twain said it or not, that sentence sums up a lot of what this book is about. Cycles vary in terms of reasons and details, and timing and extent, but the ups and downs, and the reasons for them, will occur forever, producing changes in the investment environment, and thus, in the behavior that's called for. The central line in my drawings constitutes a midpoint around which the cycle oscillates. It sometimes has an underlying direction or secular trend. Secular as in of or relating to a long term of indefinite duration, per Webster's New Collegiate Dictionary, and that's usually upward. So over time, and in the long run, economies tend to grow, companies' profits tend to increase, and largely because of those things, markets tend to rise. And if these developments were scientific or wholly natural, physical processes, economies, companies, and markets might progress in a straight line and at a constant rate, at least for a while. But, of course, they're not, so they don't. The fact is that the performance of these things is heavily influenced in the short run by, among other things, the involvement of people, and people are far from steady. Rather, they fluctuate from time to time, often because of things we can lump under the broad heading of psychology. Thus, people's behavior varies, certainly as the environment varies, but sometimes in the absence of changes in the environment, too. It's the oscillation of things around the midpoint, or secular trend, that this book is largely about. The oscillation bedevils people who don't understand it, are surprised by it, or even worse, partake in and contribute to it. But as I've said before, it often presents profit opportunities for those who understand, recognize, and take advantage of cyclical phenomena. It's clear from looking at my drawings for a few seconds that the movements of cyclical phenomena can be understood as taking place in a number of identifiable phases. A. Recovery from an excessively depressed lower extreme or low toward the midpoint. B. The continued swing past the midpoint toward an upper extreme or high. C. The attainment of a high. D. The downward correction from the high back toward the midpoint or mean. E. The continuation of the downward movement past the midpoint toward a new low. F. The reaching of a low. G. Once again, recovery from the low, back toward the midpoint. H. And then again, the continuation of the upward swing past the midpoint, toward another high. It's important to note from the above that there cannot be said to be a single starting point or ending point for a cycle. Any of the phases listed above can be described as representing the beginning of a cycle, or the end, or any stage in between. The simplistic narrator may find it easy to talk about the beginning of a cycle, but someone a bit more sophisticated can find that extremely hard. Here's what I wrote on this subject in Now It's All Bad, September 2007. Henry Kissinger was a member of TCW's board when I worked there, and a few times each year I was privileged to hear him hold forth on world affairs. Someone would ask, "Henry, can you explain yesterday's events in Bosnia?" And he'd say, "Well, in 1722, the point is that chain reaction type events can only be understood in the context of that which went before. If someone asks, "How did we get to this point?" or "What caused us to reach that high or low?" invariably the explanation has to be based on the events that went before. But, that being said, it may not be easy to figure out just how far back to reach for the starting point for your narrative. People often ask me, "What caused the cycle to begin?" or "Are we close to the end of the cycle?" I consider these improper questions, since cycles neither begin nor end. Better questions might be, "What caused the current upleg to begin?" or How far have we gone since the beginning of the upcycle? Or, are we close to the end of the downleg? You might even ask whether we're close to the end of a cycle, as long as you define it as running from one peak to the next, or from trough to trough. But, in the absence of such a definition, cycles do not have a defined beginning, and I believe they will never end. The cycle oscillates, as I mentioned, around the midpoint. The midpoint of a cycle is generally thought of as the secular trend, norm, mean, average, or happy medium, and generally as being in some sense as right and proper. The extremes of the cycle, on the other hand, are thought of as aberrations or excesses to be returned from, and generally they are. While the thing that's cycling tends to spend much of the time above or below it, eventual movement back in the direction of the mean is usually the rule. The movement from either a high or a low extreme back toward the midpoint is often described as regression toward the mean, a powerful and very reasonable tendency in most walks of life. But thinking back to the cycle stages listed above, it can also be seen that the cyclical pattern generally consists as much of movement from the reasonable midpoint toward a potentially imprudent extreme, phases B, E, and H, as it does going from an extreme back toward the midpoint, A, D, and G. The rational midpoint generally exerts a kind of magnetic pull, bringing the thing that's cycling back from an extreme in the direction of normal. But it usually doesn't stay at normal for long, as the influences responsible for the swing toward the midpoint invariably continue in force and thus cause the swing back from an extreme to proceed through the midpoint and then carry further toward the opposite extreme. It's important to recognize and accept the dependability of this pattern. The details vary, the timing, duration, speed, and power of the swings, and very importantly, the reasons for them. And that's likely what's behind Twain's remark regarding history not repeating. But the underlying dynamics are usually similar. In particular, that means the swing back from a high or low almost never halts at the midpoint, regardless of how right or appropriate the midpoint may be. The continuation of the movement past the midpoint and toward the opposite extreme is highly dependable. For example, markets rarely go from underpriced to fairly priced and stop there. Usually, the fundamental improvement and rising optimism that cause markets to recover from depressed levels remain in force, causing them to continue right through fairly priced and on to overpriced. It doesn't have to happen, but usually it does. Cycles have more potential to wreak havoc the further they progress from the midpoint. That is, the greater the aberrations or excesses. If the swing toward one extreme goes further, the swing back is likely to be more violent, and more damage is likely to be done, as actions encouraged by the cycle's operation at an extreme prove unsuitable for life elsewhere in the cycle. In other words, the potential for havoc increases as the movement away from the midpoint increases, as economies and companies do too well and stock prices go too high. Advances are followed by mere corrections, and bull markets by bear markets. But booms and bubbles are followed by much more harmful busts, crashes, and panics. What is this midpoint around which things cycle? As I said, it's often a point astride a secular trend. For example, an economy's gross domestic product may exhibit a secular annual growth rate of, say, 2%, for a few decades. But growth will be faster in some years and slower, even negative, in others. The performance in individual years is usually part of a cycle around the underlying secular trend. Importantly, the secular growth rate may be subject to a cycle as well, but a longer term, more gradual one. You have to step back further to see it. For example, societies tend to follow long-term patterns of rise and fall. Think of the Roman Empire, for example, And the short term we talk about consists of ups and downs around the long-term trend. The same can be true for industries. But since long-term cycles occur over decades and centuries, rather than quarters and years, and thus they can entail time frames that exceed any observer's lifetime, they can be hard to detect in real time and hard to factor into a decision process. Here's what I wrote on the subject in my memo, The Long View, January 2009. There's an old story about a group of blind men walking down the road in India who come upon an elephant. Each one touches a different part of the elephant, the trunk, the leg, the tail, or the ear, and comes up with a different explanation of what he'd encountered based on the small part to which he was exposed. We are those blind men. Even if we have a good understanding of the events we witness, we don't easily gain the overall view needed to put them together. Up to the time we see the whole in action, our knowledge is limited to the parts we've touched. Some of the most important lessons concern the need to A, study and remember the events of the past, and B, be conscious of the cyclical nature of things. Up close, the blind man may mistake the elephant's leg for a tree. And the short-sighted investor may think an uptrend, or a downtrend, will go on forever. But if we step back and view the long sweep of history, we should be able to bear in mind that the long-term cycle also repeats, and understand where we stand in it. This is a good time for me to make one of the most important points about the nature of cycles. Most people think of cycles in terms of the phases listed above, and recognize them as a series of events. And most people understand that these events regularly follow each other in a usual sequence. Upswings are followed by downswings, and then eventually by new upswings. But to have a full understanding of cycles, that's not enough. The events in the life of a cycle shouldn't be viewed merely as each being followed by the next, but, much more importantly, as each causing the next. For example, as the phenomenon swings toward an extreme, this movement gives it energy, which it stores. Eventually, its increased weight makes it harder for the swing to continue further from the midpoint, and it reaches a maximum beyond which it can no longer proceed. Eventually, it stops moving in that direction. And once it does, gravity then pulls it back in the direction of the central tendency, or midpoint, with the energy it has amassed powering the swing back. And as the phenomenon in question moves from the extreme back toward the midpoint, the swing imparts momentum to it that causes it to overshoot the midpoint and keep moving toward the opposite extreme. In this way, a cycle in the economic or investment world consists of a series of events that give rise to their successors. The process described in the three bullet points above sounds like a physical one, governed by forces such as gravity and momentum. But as I mentioned above, and we'll see later on, the most important deviations from the general trend, and the variation in those deviations' timing, speed, and extent, are largely produced by fluctuations in psychology. If you consider the human psyche, rather than physical attributes, to be the source of much of the energy or momentum, these three points do a pretty good job of also explaining the swings and oscillations that investors are challenged to deal with. In the chapters that follow, some of the most important content will consist of descriptions of ways in which the events in each type of cycle generate their successors. Owing to this view of cycles as progressions of causative events, this book contains several step-by-step accounts of progressions that took place in the past. The goal with each progression will be to illustrate what caused each event in the progression, what it meant in the progression, and how it contributed to the events that followed. The recounting of progressions may feel repetitive, and some of the ones covered actually will be touched on more than once, although with reference to different aspects. But hopefully these real-world examples will help readers achieve the goal of understanding cycles and how to position for them. It's extremely important to note this causal relationship, that the cycles I'm talking about consist of series of events that cause the ones that follow. But it's equally significant to note that while cycles occur in a variety of areas due to these serial events, cyclical developments in one area also influence cycles in others. Thus, the economic cycle influences the profit cycle. Corporate announcements determined by the profit cycle influence investor attitudes. Investor attitudes influence markets. And developments in markets influence the cycle in the availability of credit, which influences economies, companies, and markets. Cyclical events are influenced by both endogenous developments, including the cyclical events that precede them, as well as exogenous developments, events occurring in other areas. Many of the latter, but far from all, are parts of other cycles. Understanding these causative interactions isn't easy, but it holds much of the key to understanding and coping with the investment environment. It must be understood that while I will describe cycles as separate and discrete, this is not entirely realistic. I will provide a smooth narrative that describes the operation of each type of cycle in isolation. I will give the impression that each cycle has an independent life of its own. I may also give the impression that the swing in a given direction of one type of cycle ends before the start of a corresponding or resultant swing in a cycle of another type. That is, that they operate sequentially and independently. In other words, I will attempt to discuss each type of cycle in isolation, although in truth, they don't operate in isolation. My description might suggest that the different cycles are independent of each other and self-contained. It may seem that something happens in cycle A, which affects cycle B, which affects cycle C, which might feed all the way back to influence cycle A. This may give the impression that cycle A is on hold after it has influenced cycle B, and while cycle B's influence on cycle C takes place, but that's not the way it is. The interrelationships among the various cycles are nowhere near as neat as my descriptions will be. The various cycles operate on their own, but they also continuously affect each other. I try to tease out the various threads in my mind and treat them separately, and that is the way this book will be organized. But the well-behaved, isolated cycles I'll describe are only an analytical concept. In life, they're really a jumble of interrelated phenomena that can't be separated entirely. A affects B, and C, and B affects A, and C, and they all influence D, which influences all of them. They're all entangled with each other. But we must think about them in an orderly fashion if we are to understand cycles and their effects. Finally, perhaps under the heading of miscellany, I want to point out a few more things about the nature of cycles that are essential for a thorough understanding, starting here with a few observations from my November 2001 memo, "You Can't Predict, You Can Prepare." Cycles are inevitable. Every once in a while, an up or down leg goes on for a long time, and or to a great extreme, and people start to say, "This time it's different." They cite the changes in geopolitics, institutions, technology, or behavior that have rendered the old rules obsolete. They make investment decisions that extrapolate the recent trend. But then it usually turns out that the old rules do still apply, and the cycle resumes. In the end, trees don't grow to the sky, and few things go to zero. Rather, most phenomena turn out to be cyclical. Cycles' clout is heightened by the inability of investors to remember the past. As John Kenneth Galbraith says, "Extreme brevity of the financial memory keeps market participants from recognizing the recurring nature of these patterns and thus their inevitability." When the same or closely similar circumstances occur again, sometimes in only a few years, they are hailed by a new, often youthful, and always supremely self-confident generation as a brilliantly innovative discovery in the financial and larger economic world. There can be few fields of human endeavor in which history counts for so little as in the world of finance. Past experience, to the extent that it is part of memory at all, is dismissed as the primitive refuge of those who do not have the